So anyhow, I'm Sean, as you know. I'm going to talk about today about different models for how the population of kind of close-in, a little bit bigger than Earth-sized planets form. And I'm throwing around the term super-Earth, and hopefully you remember that doesn't mean they're necessarily like Earth, but just a bit bigger. And I'll mention some collaborators. In particular, this guy here, Andre Isidoro, is sitting right back there. I don't know if you've all met him yet. He just showed up on Tuesday, and so he's here for the next couple of months. Here we go. So just a reminder, super-Earths are anything kind of size between Earth-ish and Neptune-ish or such. So typically scales of something like 1 to 4 times the size of Earth, which corresponds maybe to something like 1 to 30-ish Earth masses. That's what I mean by super-Earths when I throw that term around here. And here's an example of some of the systems of super-Earths that we know of from Kepler, and some of the stuff that we know. So we know that they're very common. They exist around, you know, maybe a quarter, maybe a half of all stars like the Sun. They're typically found in multiple systems on relatively compact orbits, orbital configurations. And so here's a few example systems that I grabbed from the Kepler catalog. And in this case, the x-axis, the kind of the orbital distance, is on a log scale. And so the separation between planets corresponds to kind of their ratio of orbital periods or whatnot. But you can see, I mean, there's kind of a diversity in exactly what they look like, but they tend to be kind of squished pretty close. And one of these systems might be a little bit familiar to you.
Hey.
The
one?
One of them might be extra familiar to you. That's the bottom one. The bottom one is the solar system, where I just shrunk all the orbits by a factor of 10. But since it's a log scale on the x-axis, that preserves basically the kind of the dynamical spacing between planets. So you can see, for example, that the Earth-Venus dynamical spacing, their orbital period ratio, is pretty characteristic of the orbital period ratios we see among the systems, the Kepler system. So if the solar system was really shrunk down by a factor of 10, it wouldn't look all that different from lots of the Kepler systems. And so the goal of this talk is to try to explore where these things might have come from, how they got there. Now, back in the day, about in 2007 or 2008, stimulated by Eric Guidos, actually, we came up with a whole bunch of models that might explain how close-in terrestrial-like planets might form. And at that point, we had a bunch of models. There's 6 of these things. And we're trying to tell these apart by what they implied for the orbital architecture of the planetary system and maybe their composition, assuming we could tell apart different compositions with a combination of mass and radius measurements. And I made these all really small because I don't want you to dwell on the details.
I thought they were small because you shrunk the solar system by a factor of 10.
Yeah, that too, exactly.
I thought they were small because some plug-in wasn't working.
Yeah, right. But needless to say, there's all these different models. The top two are the ones that we're going to go into in a lot more detail. And there's several other models that had been proposed before we knew how super-Earth systems looked like. There were already a whole bunch of ideas of how they might form. And it turns out that most of them are already probably wrong, for at least to explain the majority of cases. So things like having these two involve giant planets that push little rocky planets around. This one is photoevaporation of planets that start off with some kind of amount of gas. And these are very simple models, and so I know people are looking at this in more detail, like Francesca.
So what you're seeing wrong, you're basically saying they fail to explain the vast majority of systems.
Exactly. They could be responsible for some limited cases, but to explain the kind of systems we were looking at before,
Right.
they can't explain those typically. And then, you know, even maybe you can have the tidal circularization model, but I'm not going to go into detail on those. So.
Just to elaborate, sorry, briefly. I should not be thinking of those as hypotheses for possible planet formation that you can falsify in some way, or?
So what these are kind of, these were, in some sense, predictive models. When we did this, we didn't know what the super-Earths were going to look like. There were only a couple examples that had been found. And based on models, we thought, well, how could you get planets that are like the Earth or maybe bigger really close to their stars? Because we know those are the ones that we're going to be able to find first. And we came up with a whole bunch of ways to do it. And most of them turned out to be, I'm not going to say wrong, because they're physically plausible, but they don't match what we see. So then I would say these two are kind of still viable to explain the majority of systems. There might be individual cases that can be explained by the other ones, but these are the two that we're going to look at in more detail. Okay, so the in-situ and migration models. And I'll actually lump another model in with that migration model.
Can I ask? Yeah. So when you say still viable, that's the conclusion of the 08 paper?
No, that's the conclusion of
today.
Of now, yeah. So in that paper, we kind of said there's a whole bunch of ways to do this, and here's what each model would predict in terms of these potentially observable things. And now, since we actually have data, tons of data on these systems, can eliminate a bunch of those because they don't match what you see. So here we go. So I just want to clarify exactly what we mean by these different models. Okay. So we just got the two. There's in-situ accretion, and there's what I'm calling here drift or migration, because they're kind of different flavors of it, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So the in-situ accretion model, what is that? It means that planets that are close in formed where you see them. It's pretty simple idea. Okay. What does it mean? It means there's a couple implications of that. One thing is that the planets kind of remember the initial conditions. So if you formed where you are, then the stuff that you form has a memory of the initial conditions. And that's the concept of the minimum mass solar nebula or extrasolar nebula. The whole idea of that is that the planets you see have some memory of what came before. Because if they don't, there's no point in building one of those nebulae. And also, there's an extra step in the chain implying that when you look at the solids, that also kind of reflects what the gas was doing. So even though the solid planets are only built from a small fraction of the stuff, this kind of model implies that you can go even further up the chain to say, we know what the solids were doing, and we know what the gas was doing, at least what it looked like. Yeah.
Well, Eric? You're probably going to get into this in detail later, so feel free to punt. But formed. What do you mean by formed? Because there's this continuum of processes that we think take you from small things to big things, from dust to...
So here I'm assuming everything in situ. So there's other processes that can move things around, like drifting of dust and pebbles and stuff. And I'll talk about that. I'm lumping those ones where things don't stay.
But disk accretes, we know that. So stuff is moving around.
Yeah,
you're presumably not questioning that. But what you're saying, I think, then, is that the solids decouple from the gas at the location.
Yeah, you're right. There's kind of an imprint of the gas disk profile at a given time.
So the verb formed could be fine-tuned to be grew from size X to size Y, where you see them. And those sizes would be?
I mean, small to big. We'll stay hand-wavy here.
Okay.
Right, but at the same time, physicists are thinking like physicists, and I'm thinking like a chemist. The disk is changing composition.
Right.
And that's all.
So you're right. So in reality, the disk is constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that you can kind of take a snapshot of the disk that really represents the whole thing is kind of, it doesn't make that much sense.
Right. When I describe the Earth and its volatility signature, I always say it's the integrated product of all the processes that happen.
Yeah. It's like the snow line. The snow line is not a static thing. It moves in time, but at some point, it had the kind of the most profound impact in terms of imprinting a division between dry stuff and wet stuff. So the timing is kind of built into it.
Can I ask a chemistry question? How big do you have to be before you stop equilibrating with the local disk and you're, essentially locked in no matter where you move? That's a fuzzy question, but...
You mean how big do the solids have to be before they basically are chemically decoupled from the gas?
That's right.
I could think of chondrites, which are, things you can hold in your hands and all the particles are unequilibrated.
Okay.
So
But the individual constituents themselves were.
They are unequilibrated.
So
and they make a planet that we say looks like that chondrite.
I mean, one micron.
From this size to that to planet.
But the grain size, tiny sizes, they
it
are.
Could be as small as a micron, because we know there are unequilibrated material that small in unaltered chondrites.
Yeah.
But in the case of chondrules, for example, there's some equilibration with something. Might be the disc, might be something else, and those are up to a fraction of a centimeter.
Right. That's as big as
I think if you get bigger than a centimeter, it starts to get very difficult. You start to lose contact with the chemical contact with the disc. But it depends also very much on the temperature and the pressure.
So just to continue, one other kind of implication of the in-situ accretion model is you have to assume that migration doesn't happen because everything's forming in-situ and it's not moving around. So that's just some kind of extra baggage that goes along with it.
I really object to that. That's just not fair. You know, I mean, you're purposely putting up a straw man that's going to be so weak. I mean, clearly there are hybrid cases where you form somewhere and you move a little bit, 10%, 3%, 20% of the original center major axis. So I just don't want you to set up a target that is just so easy to shoot at. Planets can form where they form and then move 50% of the distance. This, like any other taxonomy, these two categories, which I agree we should all sort of keep in mind, are constructs that are somewhat artificial, and there's going to be hybrids.
Sure.
Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah, this is kind of the simplest case.
Okay.
So, long-range migration.
It's
just not fair.
You have to go a log scale in distance to kind of migrate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not fair to say it does not happen. I mean, no one would say that because it's physics that makes migration happen. So that's causal.
I agree.
So what range of migration would you allow to still fall under that category?
I think Ruth just had a good suggestion.
Order of magnitude, log scale.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. If you have to represent it on a log scale in here.
Yeah, if you're going from 0.1 AU to, if you have to go from 1 AU to 0.1,
yeah,
or you have to go,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
2 AU to 0.2, then that's a big difference.
Okay. Yeah.
Sean, building one of these is ultimately a mixing problem. And scale length for this migration, not just log scale, but must scale somehow with the radius of the thing that's growing.
Yeah, I mean, how fast you migrate depends on the planet's size. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, it's just you're building it, and it's sampling the environment around it to build it. And that mixing process is folded into how stable its position is. So the question is how you go from Ruth's picture of just an order of magnitude variation. Can you include the fact that as you build this thing and it's spinning and changing its mass and making a hole in the disk that it's sampling from?
So I compare the
I think I appreciate Sean's point, and that you really say this is not significant or it's secondary.
Yes.
But that leads
in some sense, with regards to what Jeff was saying, that this is kind of not fair. It's true, it's not. It's not very fair. But that's because if you want to do this step, which is building, if you want to say that the plants you see represent the initial conditions, then you have to, this is a requirement.
Well,
otherwise you're saying, oh, but our disk is not actually right.
It's the language. And to say it does not happen is too strong. To say that it's a weak effect within Ruth's order of magnitude is fair, I would say. So.
But maybe instead of just saying an order of magnitude and distance, the point is, does it drift a long distance compared to the distance on which the disk properties change substantially for your purposes?
Or absolutely.
The planet growth time scale, does the drift time scale across distances where the disk changed substantially compare, is that larger or smaller than the planet growth time scale?
Yeah.
I mean, then you're actually asking about physics. Yeah.
And it depends what they're growing from. Whether, that's a different story.
My expectation is that to actually answer that, if you're not asking really detailed questions, you do have to move an order of magnitude rather than a factor of two, but maybe that's not true if you do it in detail. That's where my expectation that you need to move a large distance for it to be meaningful comes from.
Yeah.
But that order of magnitude migration is just exactly where the solar system versus those are. You, in your first slide, you just moved order of magnitude. That's borderline, it's just.
Exactly, an order of magnitude can be a long way.
Right, if you go from outside the ice line to these super Earths and they're made of ice, then they have gone more than an order of magnitude in distance. So that is substantial. That's very different from in situ formation.
Right.
So for the qualitative difference between whether these are forming in place super Earths or migrating from outside the snow line, mini Neptunes, all of these will give you the same answer. Those are distinct scenarios.
Okay, I'll continue. So what is the migration model all about? So the idea is pretty simple. The idea is that the stuff you're actually building your, you know, presumably solid or planets that have a lot of solids in them, the solids come from somewhere else. So they come from further out. Okay, that's the idea. And so how do they get there? They probably have to either drift in at very small sizes, things that are like a centimeter or maybe a meter in size, or at very big sizes, things that are maybe Mars size or bigger. And so when I talk about kind of small sizes, things like meter size, that's generally called, you know, that's what I'm referring to as the drift model. That's when small particles are drifting in, kind of like dust or slightly bigger things drift inward. And then you build your planets there. The migration model would be where you build at least cores further out. You know, by cores, I mean things that are Mars size, further out, and they migrate inward and, you know, are already big when they're migrating inward. That's the distinction.
Can I just, I mean, since this is such a collegial and constructive group, I would say, which is a precursor to a slam. You're ugly and you should die tomorrow. But otherwise, I mean, smart Alan.
That was so much nicer when you weren't here.
I know, exactly. You should probably add a bullet above your top bullet that is analogous to the top bullet on the left side, which is the formation process itself, but after which the migration occurs. Because there's challenges in the formation, or let me say, not challenges, but there are issues associated with formation, time scales of formation, how much gas, blah, blah, blah. So, you know.
So it's true. Well, the thing is, the drift and migration have different bullets for that. So the drift one would be planets really do form close in, but the material to get there comes from further out. Whereas the migration would be the things get big further out and then come in.
So you're actually talking about formation in those.
Yeah, so these are, that's the difference between drift and migration. Drift is small guys going in,
I see.
And then building, you know, they probably accrete
mostly
close in. Whereas the migration, you form them big further out and then they go.
So in
both cases, the mass is coming from further out, but they either get big and then go in or go in and they get big.
That's
order.
Yeah. Is the distinction that you're making between drift and in situ accretion, because that's not the distinction that's not what I would have assumed you meant by this distinction. So just to understand what you do mean, is it's in situ if the local solid to gas ratio stays similar to interstellar, whereas it's the drift scenario if you have enhanced the local solid to gas ratio, is that?
Yeah, exactly.
So bullet number one on the left could actually also be on the right. The planets could form where you see them, but by migration of material.
Oh, I guess I could have made a third column for the drift to explain how it's different. It's kind of in between the two more extreme cases.
No, it's a different case, it seems like.
I think we decided that the first bullet had to be, the terminology had to be replaced by this decoupling between the gas and the solids.
That's a good way to put it. Whether the solids really trace the gas or whether they're independent. And then there's also the extra factor of whether they're getting built close in or not. Cool.
So when I think I need to be corrected. When I thought of your in situ accretion, I sort of conjured up in my mind some defined annulus that is the complete feeding zone. So if you think of the Earth at 1 AU, we kind of, let's say a half an AU surrounding the original disk, and that's what's the complete planet grew from.
Sure.
So that's a good way to think about it.
So exactly.
It's just that annulus.
Yeah, exactly. This is what Hilke was talking about on Tuesday, about how to calculate, you know, the width of a feeding zone of a planet in different scenarios. So in the in-situ model, you know, Hilke was showing that she had trouble forming big planets with the in-situ model, even if you have enough mass to make the planets big enough. So I'm not going to go into detail on that argument again, but I'll mention it again. So
actually,
so
from
right.
Hilke's model, I was drifting.
One variation is, I think, with, say, the drift model, you can still imagine that annulus, but it's just not constant in time. So as the object moves in, it moves closer in and it grows wider as the growth process occurs.
Right. And when you say not constant in time, you can define your space, but you can actually add mass to it. That's what you mean by not constant.
Well, I was thinking if the planet material that's going to make the planet was drifting in, then as the protocore grows up, the location that it's accreting from moves closer into the star. The annulus shrinks in total diameter, but the width of the annulus as it grows may start to increase.
You mean the Hilsphere grows?
Sure. Yeah.
Right, okay. I understand. It's a very complicated problem.
I have one more bullet point. Oh, yeah. And so why does migration stop? Well, there's different ways that inward drifting things might stop. They can be trapped at, what did I write here? At pressure bumps in the disk, so places where there's a local pressure maximum, or at the inner edge of the disk, where you just kind of run out of gas to keep pushing you inward, or they could be drifting in and the gas goes away and be stranded somewhere closer to the star. So those are different ways that migration can stop.
Yeah. I'm a little lost, so I just want to make sure I'm not more lost. When I think people use the word, when people use the term migration, they normally mean, or meant, at least historically, a planet that was already essentially fully formed, and then it interacted with the disk either by, say, type 1 or type 2, and the planet as a defined, almost complete entity, you know, moved. The drift idea here that you're talking about seems very different, qualitatively different to me. So it feels to me like there needs to be three columns.
I see what you mean, yeah. Yeah, drift is kind of it's similar in some ways to the migration, but it's not the same.
It's a different thing. I mean, drift is drift of smaller objects that are still in the process of growing, whereas migration is a term we normally represent, you know, the motion of the whole planet nearly fully formed.
Right? Yeah, so he's using the words differently than Hilke was using, which also confused me for a long time last week.
And in fact, I think some people implicitly include drift in the in situ accretion.
Yeah.
Category, and so when they talk about this distinction, they would put drift on the left side. So actually, breaking it out into three pieces.
I agree. Yeah,
that's a good point. I'll do that in the future.
Is there a continuum possible?
Yeah, there's the two aspects: where the mass comes from, and where the planet actually grows.
And
so maybe it's best to just separate all of them.
Right.
So, just to make sure we are all on the same page. So here's a little cartoon. Super Earths forming by in-situ accretion. What happens? Boom. So close in, things start off as planetesimals and they grow bigger. And then you form your things locally. That's the in-situ model. And then I included, you know, further out in the disk where presumably there's more stuff and you can build things like maybe the cores of giant planets or something like that. But here the hot super Earths would be over here. So that's just one. And this does happen. Here's a simulation I ran a long time ago of this kind of thing happening. Here we were trying to reproduce Gliese of 581. And so if you start with a disk that has enough mass in it, so that top panel is just a whole bunch of planetesimals and planetary embryo stuff, basically the building blocks of planets. And they bash together in time and form a few different planets down there. And the color is not really important for this talk, so don't worry about that too much. But you're able to form things that are, you know, 6.6, 10, you know, 11 Earth masses. So you can form big things close to their star. And it happens pretty fast. In this case, in about 1 million years.
And you started this at a stage where the gas was basically gone.
Yeah, here there's no gas.
So your premise is that if you can get to these rocky stages with negligible gas, then you can grow them up to the right size.
Exactly.
And what Hilco is complaining about last week was maybe it's not viable to get to your top panel, right?
Yeah. And she was saying, well, she was looking at even the feeding zones during this process.
Well, but really, she saw the gas there.
She had the gas there during the...
No, she says in the later part she did,
but in earlier parts of her talk where she was talking about the feeding zones during accretion, I don't think she was considering damping from the gas.
She was limiting the initial conditions in the top panel to the majority of the mass being in objects of an isolation mass. And the motivation for that was growing it while the gas was around. But I think that for this purpose, and correct me if I'm wrong, the implication of that assumption is that you have to start with that top panel with everything in isolation masses.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think if you have mass ratios between things that are larger, you can effectively get a wider feeding zone.
Sean, so just out of curiosity, all the little dots in the third panel, when do they actually disappear? Because they seem to be gone by a million years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know off the top of my head from this case, but yeah, within a million years,
like
they're all cleared out.
3,000 Amala scale or closer to a million years?
I don't know off the top of my head. This kind of, so if you scale this process outward, like for the Earth, if you were scaling this out to the Earth, where Earth is, you know, say this guy out at 1 AU, then to clean up all the leftover junk would take hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah.
And so to do it much closer in, also in a disk that has more mass, the whole thing happens faster. So the punchline is that it happens faster, but I don't know off the top of my head how fast.
And this would be a archetype in situ, because really the blue and the red stay on their respective sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's things forming, you know, locally. The feeding zone of each planet, it's not like each thing forms exactly from the stuff that's right there.
Right, that's what I wanted to understand, was the scale of the...
Yeah, there's kind of, even in the in situ model, there's feeding zones, and so planets form from a distribution material that form in different locations.
I guess I didn't really know why you said exactly what you said, Bill, because, for example, the second planet out in the bottom panel has lots of water in it. That water certainly came from farther out, where you look at the top panel where all the blue is in it. So the water came from, you know, a factor of 3 farther away.
Is that right, or the snow line's closer in for this?
Well, in this case, I scaled it in some way. And so, yeah, so you can see the division between red and blue stuff at the start is something like a quarter of an AU.
And the top panel, the blue dots didn't come from further away. He started the blue dots there.
No, but the planet ended up much closer.
Oh, okay.
The feeding zone of this guy is broad enough
that
it included plenty of material from out here.
And by the way, I mean, this is not your main point, but one of the things I've loved about Sean's work over the years, and we've talked about it, is the distribution of water. That's the topic of a lot of Sean's papers, and it always moved me that he so easily gets planets, if you just kind of look by eye, that have a whole lot of water.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid, right?
That are kind of close in. Like, whole lot meaning way more than 10 to the minus 3-ish, like, for the Earth.
How about the other simulations, like the Nice model? Will they get the same thing with water or no?
Well, the Nice model is for the solar system, for the late evolution of the solar system.
Yeah, but would they have the same distribution for water or no?
It's not doing the same.
Yeah, well, they don't do formation.
It's totally different.
There's whole other models for that.
So they don't track the water.
But it's fair to say anybody simulation that anybody runs gets a lot of mixing, and it's typical that material gets moved around. And
when you form stuff, you know, even
stuff happens.
Yeah, there's a problem. You can't avoid having mixing.
Gen,
so is it really mixing, or is it primarily the migration?
So there's no migration here. So this is just mixing. All this is basically, you can think of it as kind of gravitational mixing.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason that things don't form only like purely locally is because scattering between objects makes them spread out. I guess I could have put a movie to show that better for the solar system. I don't have any movies of this. But so what's happening is objects are scattering each other around. And so the time it takes for one of these guys to get accreted is long compared to the time to get scattered around and move around.
Let me put it another way. I understand, I see by eye that the inner planets have a lot of water in at the end. Are the compositions of all those objects identical, effectively? So is the whole system well mixed by the end?
No. I mean, this guy still has less water. I mean, you can't tell. Uh-huh. He's greener, and these guys have more.
Yeah.
Typically, if you start with, you know, a boundary, and so your source of volatiles of water is beyond a certain distance, then at least if you have a high enough mass in your solids, then there's mixing such that you get some water close in. But there's still a gradient where the closer you are, the less you have, usually.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask, the stopping mechanism applies to the, whether it is a drifter or migrator?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit. Okay, so this is with no migration or drift.
Yeah.
It's just in situ. This is just to show that in situ can work.
Yeah, we'd be interested in your results that include gas, for example. Maybe that's on the slides coming.
Oh yeah, there's more stuff. So,
I guess just again on the point of the water line, so or the ice line, is the diagonal, so the ice line kind of like just looking by color, is that random or?
In a real disk, the snow line moves around in time, and so as the disk evolves, the snow line generally sweeps inward. At the very end, it goes out, but that's not what it generally sweeps inward.
Okay.
And so at some point, it kind of imprints on the disk by condensation mechanisms. You know, that only objects beyond a certain distance will have water, a certain amount of water.
Yeah.
And so this is assuming that that happened at this point. And then if you just have accretion happen after that, you still get plenty of mixing of some of this blue stuff inward.
Okay, but I mean, so then the fact that it's kind of like, that diagonal where green kind of like has this diagonal line, is that just kind of coincidence?
Oh, that it goes down like this? Kind of,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's just kind of the time. It takes time for the stuff to get scattered in.
Okay.
And so at the end, this guy's got some amount of water from out there, but it doesn't happen instantaneously. Like this guy is still completely dry. It takes a while for.
That's the thing. I mean, just at the beginning, it looks like there's a lot of dry stuff, almost half right, like dry and wet. And then at the end, you end up with mostly wet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is the plant up that's like 0.3 AU sampling any of the red stuff?
It should be. Yeah. I mean, you can see there's plenty of red stuff scattered out here.
So. Yeah.
Is, I don't have the feeding zones of these plants.
Yeah.
I would make a suggestion. Let's Sean move on because that's the starting point. Yeah. Really interesting work since 2008.
Yeah,
he's just going to show
us. This is supposed to be just a proof of principle that the institute can work. And I didn't have a plot without the colors to show. But all right. This next slide is going to make Jeff very angry. Problems with the in situ model. Okay. And this is, I'm just going to go through these quickly. But actually, it probably won't happen. I don't know why.
Okay.
All right. So the first point is if you're doing the in situ, so remember, I'm assuming no drift here. Okay. We'll get to the whole drift thing later. Assuming things, you know, super Earths form locally from. Solids that started off there, you need to have really massive disks. Okay? You need to have enough mass that you have those solids. And that is a lot more than we expect. It's typically 10 to 100 times more than we expect.
And of course, I can't help it already. Expect is a word, but we don't have any measurements of disk densities at all.
That's true. So yeah, not in the inner parts. Not inside, 1028?
Expect, I mean, is an interesting word because it's a constructive word. We're struggling as a community to come up with a good model of planet formation, which probably suggests that one of our expectations, or maybe several of our expectations about initial conditions, isn't quite right. So it's okay. But
that's totally true.
Yeah.
Well, what's really required is a mass in solids close to the star, which would require a solid gas disk ratio, which is atypical compared to interstellar, given the total disk masses that are observed at slightly larger distances and extrapolated inwards.
Right.
That's
a good
way to put it, yeah.
It's more than slightly larger distances. So you have to extrapolate the disk masses over two orders of magnitude in separation
right.
to go from 100 AU, where they're mostly measured, into 0.1, to go down from 40 AU, where they're mostly measured, into
0.4
AU. Yeah. If it's a power law over those distances, then this is exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's the simplest assumption, but we know that accretion disks are complicated, so it's certainly not required.
But also, we do have measurements of accretion rates, or at least estimates, and although those do depend on what we think exactly the physics of the accretion is, there's some consistency at least, and they do not sort of predict these kinds of very massive disks close to the star.
That's true. That's
so you'd have to do something funny with those models too.
There's a two order of magnitude spread in those accretions there. So that's true if you take the typical ones, I completely agree. But there's a big spread there.
Steve, come on in.
Hi.
Have a seat. Join the argument.
Okay, so now, so I'm not going into too much detail on this, but if you make the assumption that you can build one of these disks, a minimum mass disk that represents the initial conditions for planet formation, what we call minimum mass extrasolar nebula, and that's really representative of the whole disk. So if that's true, then there's some problems such that a lot of them have very weird density profiles, radial density profiles that increase steeply with orbital distance, for example, that are not easily explained by what we know or what we think we might know about disks. And a second point is that if this is true, if these disks really represent the entire disk structure, then all of these systems with hot super-Earths should also have more distant gas giant planets, because you would have so much mass out there. Because you're taking a sort of disk and scaling it up enough to have enough mass in the inner parts that you would also have it in the outer parts.
Sean, can you just, for perhaps my benefit, current disk physics, what does that mean?
So it's basically assuming a certain structure, a certain evolution of the disk. Like assuming it has some kind of internal viscosity that's governed by certain physics, you expect a certain range of surface density slopes that are kind of easily explainable. And many of these kind of minimum mass disks that you would construct fall well outside that range. And so maybe it's possible with completely different assumptions, but with kind of the standard assumptions, you can't do it.
The physics that governs viscous evolution is not well understood. That's why there's presence.
So you're saying there needs to be more mass to make the giant planet occur. Is that the inconsistency?
Is that if you imagine you take a disk like the minimum mass solar nebula, and to produce system of hot super-Earths, you have to scale it up by, say, a factor of 10. That means that you have enough mass close to the star to build your hot super-Earth there. If you do that everywhere, then further out you have a lot more mass too. And so you have enough stuff to build giant planets further out. And so if you really are scaling up the disks that we are familiar with up more, then you'd have a lot more mass further out, and so you would predict a lot higher frequency of giant planets.
But if you don't scale it up at all, do you think you get the giant planet occurrence that you expect?
Oh, if you don't scale it up at all, would you get it? That's a good question. So there's a lot of holes in terms of how we get it. So you're right that most models require scaling up the disk in the outer parts by a factor of a few in order to build giant cores at all. So that's true. So in general, that what's called the minimum mass solar nebula model assumes that everything that was in this disk ended up in planets, basically. And we don't think that that mechanism is that efficient. So it makes sense to scale it up a little bit, you're right. We think that this is probably too much. What else have I got here? This is the thing that Hilke was talking about the other day, but we kind of mentioned that a little bit in passing, so I don't want to dwell on that. What else are they going to say? The planets form very fast, naturally, like in that thing I was showing. And so it makes sense that if planets form that fast, that interactions between the planets and the disk should be doing something. And models suggest that things like gas-driven migration should.
I just want to understand the word fast. 10 to the 5 years?
Yeah, that's a good ballpark for those kind of close. So a caveat is, it's 10 to the 5 years after you have kind of the building blocks of planets. So maybe, you know, one way to rescue, in some sense, this kind of model is to invoke that it takes a long time to form your planetesimal system. And that's not impossible. Maybe that happens. And finally, I think the last thing I was going to say, many planets are actually located closer to their stars than we think should even have dust in the first place. And so this is kind of, if you're forming planets locally, you wouldn't expect to be able to form planets so close that you can't even have dust condensed.
How many?
Sorry?
How many? I guess that's based on the Kepler sample, so.
Yes, I don't know the number. I was going to calculate this a month or two ago, but I never did. So I don't know. But at least some. This paper is a cool example of one system where there are several planets in there. And off the top of my head, I don't know. That's a good question.
You don't have to move them very far to avoid.
No, you're right. This is like a factor of two kind of thing.
Yeah. And so, that's that, you know, the objection, of course, would be that if you, you know, prevent any migration from happening in an in situ model, you're setting up a straw man. And, you know, obviously, because planet-planet interactions occur, you can certainly move. If you've got a whole bunch of planets that are at 0.1 AUs, planet-planet interactions are going to move a few of them interior to the dust sublimation radius. About the bullet above it, planets form very fast. I think that's a straw man too, because the standard model for the formation of our own terrestrial planets in our own solar system took 50 million years or so, or whatever the right number is. So by forcing, imposing a planet formation very fast, and then saying, well, then gas-driven migration doesn't happen. I mean, somehow we have our own solar system. We have to explain it.
This number, I mean, the very fast comes from assuming a mechanism similar to for Earth, which we don't know exactly. Something like 50, 100 million years. You know, if we call that the formation time for Earth, then this is much faster because we're going a lot closer to the star, and we're putting ourselves in an environment with a lot more mass. So more stuff to bash into and faster time scales. And yeah. So just scaling in a simple way from the Earth gives you very short time scales.
But again, I'm just trying to give you my honest feedback. You're harping on migration, then, you know, it says right there, not reasonable to assume gas-driven migration doesn't happen. It's just too strong. Nobody would say that it doesn't happen. It will happen within factors of two.
It's not a double negative. It does happen.
Yeah, you're saying it's reasonable to assume, so I think it softens the
thing. Well,
yeah.
I guess, what is the concern here about the migration? Have you not observed the effects of migration?
Well, if you're assuming planets,
or that they would migrate into the star, or what?
The migration model is a whole separate thing, so I'm going to talk about that next. The reason I harp on this is because the idea of forming things locally is not, I have no really objection to the forming things where they are. The part that I don't like is using what you see to infer the initial conditions.
I think
and
that's
for
fair.
That to be true, you have to ignore migration.
I think that's fair.
So that's the part where you have to ignore migration. Not that you can't ever have radial mixing, because I think that's reasonable.
And this goes back to Ruth's basic idea, which is that we're talking about spatial scales within which we see planets. How far do they move relative to the disk density scale length radially, and some comparison between the two scales.
Yeah, but I do think, you know, Sean's basic point that it's very dangerous to take the distribution of planets and use that to infer initial conditions has to be true. And also, it's true that if you take the Earth formation models and scale them to these short distances, they have to be a lot faster.
Right.
I mean, that's just a dynamical time scale.
Right.
So you're not saying here, okay, that's why this is a little bit confusing. You're not saying that if the in-situ model were correct, that migration is disallowed somehow by the observation. Subsequent migration is disallowed by the migration. You're just saying that the premise of the in-situ migration, in-situ formation, is flawed because we're going to get migration, significant migration anyway.
Yeah. It's the same for the minimum mass solar nebula. By taking what you see and inferring initial conditions, you're assuming that it was a local process.
Yeah.
And so you're assuming the migration was not important. And exactly how important is kind of what Ruth was mentioning. Maybe you can, you know, put a number on that. But what I am arguing here is that these kind of almost silly kind of assumptions that everyone who's worked on
you know, gas disk interaction, or, you know, disk planet interactions was wrong. That comes out of really assuming that you can take the super Earth you see and infer true initial conditions. So I'm not objecting to a lot of the parts of building planets close in, but that step, I think, is.
And it's really worth remembering. I think this is a great discussion because we're beginning to coalesce around a notion that some hybrid type models make a lot of sense. There's some amount of gas around, probably, because the planets, even the mini Neptunes, show that they have some gas. But they don't have very much gas, right? Because they didn't accumulate very much, or they probably did. There wasn't much gas in the disk, otherwise they would have accreted more gas. So, you know, you could imagine models that are sort of hybrids in which, for whatever reason, when the planets formed that we see, there wasn't very much gas around compared to the solids.
Yeah, I mean,
but some around, so that there's some migration.
So I know it's already getting late. I guess I'll do it quick. What was I gonna do? I'll get to that atmospheres part later. So let me just introduce the other model. And I'll just show a movie and not go into much detail. Is that good? So the cartoon picture migration. Here's what we do. Start with some small things. They grow some cores or whatnot. Or by cores, I mean planetary embryos, mm-hmm. things that are maybe Mars size, further out maybe even Earth size. These are things we think of as kind of things that bash into each other to form the cores of Jupiter and Saturn. And then they go inward. And they go up because they're growing a little bit, and then that's what you do. That's what your hot super Earth in this moment.
Do they eat the little ones, or do they push them into the star?
They do it all both. Yeah.
They do it simultaneously, not like you show, right? They grow.
So you're right. They can either all be migrating together or one at a time. It depends on the formation times.
No, but for each of them, you show something like they first migrate and then.
Oh, so the going up was trying to represent like a collision with a rocky embryo. Kind
of. Oh.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, if they could go up smoothly or they could go up in things. And they could all kind of form at a similar time and go together, or one could form at a time. Those are details that we don't really know.
But they always look like Europa.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I think it's like a characteristic icy thing. Like Europa. All right, so migration. I don't want to go into too much of the details of it, but type 1 migration, the idea here is when you have an object that's larger than something like a Mars mass, it has an effect on the disk. So it launches density waves within the gaseous disk. So what this image is showing is a planet right here that has caused density perturbations in a gaseous disk in which it's embedded. And so you can see kind of this spiral thing. These are spiral waves generated by the planet. There's also another zone that's perturbed right around the orbit of the planet. And there's a back reaction of these density waves on the orbit of the planet. And that causes the planet's orbit to shrink or grow. And so inward is when the orbit shrinks, and outward is when it grows. And so kind of in general, these kind of really bright waves that you see, these are they're generated at Lindblad resonances, interior and exterior of the planet's orbit. And they generally, in most cases, cause the planet to orbit, to migrate inward.
If you have a perfectly smooth disk.
Yeah, you're right. The torque that's generated from this kind of material that's co-rotating with the planet can go either way. In this regime, it generally goes outward. And so in some cases, it can overwhelm this other torque, and the planet's orbit can actually get bigger.
If that is the case, you can explain the solar system that way.
Well, let's not get that far yet. That's the general idea of migration at all. So we think that objects, when they're small, when things are smaller than Mars size, then they can, you know, they interact with the disk, you know, they can feel different effects like gas drag, but they don't generate strong enough density waves to have the disk gravitationally push them around. You need to be at least, you know, Mars size or a little bigger.
So that depends on the mass of the disk, right?
Sure.
Knowing next to nothing about these kinds of calculations. Would this image that I see have a relatively uniform particle and density distribution? And when I say uniform, I don't even know how wide of a distribution. And then are electromagnetic effects being taken account?
In this kind of disk, typically you assume some kind of viscosity prescription, like an alpha viscosity, which implies a certain and you also include, what else is included? Thermal diffusion within the disk. There's simplified radiative transfer in these kind of disks. In general, when the detailed effects of the dust are not really considered except by their through these other mechanisms. And so so what this image is showing is also not the actual surface density distribution, but the perturbed density distribution because of the planet. Otherwise, it would have some kind of gradient, radio gradient.
And particle size?
That only comes in a simplified way. So it's assumed that the opacity is dominated by small particles. So it's assuming things are small.
It's a continuum model.
I think it's only a computational effect, right? So.
Yeah, it matters. So those kind of effects matter in terms of the radiative transfer, the opacities within the disk that determine the temperature distribution, which has a feedback that's especially important for one of the torques, the co-rotation torque. Yeah, but it's really the gas mass that's doing the pushing.
Let's try to wrap this one up in 5 minutes.
Okay, so let me skip ahead. Let me just show you, I'll just show you kind of one example. So if you have a, if you apply how we think type 1 migration works onto a given disk profile, then you can get something like this. So what this is showing is, as a function of how big your planet is, how massive it is, and orbital distance, what if you stick a planet in there, how it should migrate. So the colors are such that blue means you migrate inward pretty fast. Red means you migrate outward pretty fast. And so these solid lines kind of are enclosing regions where planets would migrate outward. Okay, so imagine you're a little small guy here. You would migrate inward. If you're a medium-sized guy here, you go outward until you stop there. So I know this is kind of a weird concept. That's how it goes. So if you're following, you follow arrows, and then in some cases you can go up. The key thing that's most important in this model is the idea that based on our current understanding with what we think are pretty good disk models, there's an edge gradient. So to migrate outward requires that your planet is pretty massive. So planets that are things that are just kind of forming from small stuff, they go inward. And only when an object becomes at least, say, 5-ish Earth masses can it hope to go back out. And so these kind of guys would be saved, in some sense, from migrating inward.
And this is with the savior mechanism of the co-rotation torque, still assuming a smooth disk.
Yeah. This can have a certain, you know, structure and so on, but there's no kinks in the surface density.
And there's an edge to the disk, like starting to
show. And there is, yeah, and this, here we have an edge at 0.1. And so planets won't fall on the star, they'll stop at an edge, which we impose here at 0.18.
They can move in and then change their mind and move out because they grow enough?
Well, so if they want to go out, they have to do so before about 0.18. Because this little region never does too much. Don't worry about too much about this guy. But this one can really save planets that would otherwise go and become, you know, close into the star. So in this model, if you're migrating in, if an embryo forms out here, the only way it's going to avoid going all the way in is if it crosses this vertical line and comes out.
And then it goes back.
And then it goes out, and it stops somewhere where the torques cancel out.
And this is including all the resonance? I mean, what kind of calculation?
There's only one
this is, yeah, there's no, this is not, I mean, this is for just one single planet, so you don't worry about it.
I understand, right.
And so this is where basically the differential min by the torque cancels out the co-rotation torque for a given disk model. So they're equal.
But I'm wondering, what is the calculation which is behind this plot? It's what kind of calculation do you make in order to get the migration?
It's for an imposed density profile and using formulas for type 1 migration based on that.
But there are some approximations there. So I wonder if it is fully numerically, or is it just...
So So this particular model is based on, is, I would put it medium. There's very, the best models that are out there right now are by Bertrand Beach. And his models have the same general structure. There's some details, like he doesn't have this little thing going on. And that's the only significant difference. But we can talk more about that. Let me just show, because I'm about out of time. So let me just show an example. So here's just kind of a proof of concept simulation. You got some, assuming you form some planetary cores further out, we can see kind of what they do. So in this case, again, we're looking at mass versus distance. And these kind of shaded areas are where things would migrate outward instead of inward. And so what you see is things kind of migrate inward. When they're bigger, they migrate faster. They go inward and they reach the inner edge of the disk and then they kind of pile up there. They pile up in chains of resonances. And in this particular example, chosen because it's a cool one, one guy got big enough to go outward and become what we consider, you know, maybe a giant planet core or something like that. And so in this case, at the end, while the gas is still around, you have a system of some number of what I call hot super-Earths kind of that are trapped at the inner edge of the disk. And
So what fraction of systems have both a, like, did you generate a number of these simulations and did like an ensemble? I'm wondering like how much we can use this kind of thing to explain different deficits in the period or semi-major axis distribution.
I think at the moment, I wouldn't use it to explain that kind of thing. It's more of a proof of concept.
What the theory says is that the locations of these depend on the temperature and pressure profile or the surface density profiles, say, of the disk. So you can tweak those and move these around somewhat. But we don't know.
I'll stop. I just want to show one little blurb, and I just want to mention that what this movie is showing is what happens while the gas is still around. Unfortunately, I don't have a good movie of this happening. I gotta make. But anyhow, so what happens is, you know, these things all migrated inward and they got stuck here in this model, and in this situation, in this configuration, they're in a chain of orbital resonances. And that's not what we see, as Dan was talking about last week. But what happens is this is within the gas disk. And so in the context of the same model, as the gas goes away, these things, these kind of configurations don't remain stable, at least most of the time. And so usually you actually enter a phase where they have a late kind of cleanup phase where there are some big collisions as the gas is going away. And so most of the time they don't stay in resonance. Once in a while they do, but more often they don't. And so the idea that migration means that planets have to stay in resonance is not true, at least for this situation. But I know I've taken too much time, so I don't want to keep going too much.
No, that was very good, by the way. Thank you.
I have more about the drip model and other stuff, but I can talk about it another time, because I know Becky's up.
So Becky, why don't you set up, and then if you want one more question, well, Becky.